Great.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. You're here for the Journey Home with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we just started reading this wonderful book by our friend Ken Wapnick called The Journey Home. And you can get it from the Foundation for Inner Peace, or you can also get it off Amazon. On I got mine on Kindle. So, but it's The Journey Home, and it's talking about the obstacles to peace from A Course in Miracles. And we just read the preface and the introduction and everything last week, and we're getting ready to start with chapter one. So, Bruce, you know, what's going on with you? And if you're ready, we can start reading or whatever you like.
Well, I do have a couple of quick announcements. I posted several new conversations, including a year's worth of our conversations on ACIM blog. That includes the beginning and through the end of our conversations reading Gary Wright's fourth book. So if anybody wants to have a, shall we say, a heavily augmented audiobook of the lifetimes when Jesus and Buddha knew each other, The History of Mighty Companions, Gary R. Renard's fourth book, they can go to ACIM blog, and it's the second, currently the second item in the sidebar, but you can find it easily enough on my homepage also and elsewhere. There's about three or four dozen audio recordings of yours truly and yourself, then. Reading that wonderful book aloud, and that was my second reading, and I guess I'm now queued up to do a third one. So anyway I thought we covered a lot of good ground in addition to just the reading of the book itself. So if anybody wants to just, you know, instead of doing the visual method, do the auditory method, you can listen to about a year's worth of us reading on this program, which we've just renamed to The Journey Home in honor of the book we're reading, probably for, I would think, probably a couple of years it'll probably take us to get through it because there's so much in it, by Ken Wapnick. So, also on the ACIM blog site, I just posted I've written a review, but I'm still working on it because it's just a wonderful book. Can't say enough good things about it. This is Dr. Bob, Robert Rosenthal's latest book, his second book, From Nevermind to Evermind. And it's actually, I read a pre-release version, and it's going to be out within the next few weeks. And it's a wonderful book. It's actually the first in a series of five books. And I think this is going to be one of those books we look back and say, wow, this is a book that, you know, really, you know, added a tremendous amount and, you know, kind of set the bar for, you know, course-related books yet higher, along with Gary's books, Ken's books, and so many others, of course. This is just a wonderful overview of A Course in Miracles, starting with some basic ideas, and it's just really a wide net he's casting here in terms of the audience, by opening it up to anyone who's never heard of the course, and yet just presenting some of the more challenging ideas in really easy to understand analogies and metaphors and case studies from his many years as a practicing, you know, board certified psychotherapist and psychiatrist, and which a practice he just quit a couple of years ago to become the co-president of the Foundation for Inner Peace. And I've been working with him on the website, and although probably more a peripheral role, the other co-president, Tam Morgan, and I worked more closely on it for over 3 years, which just launched a few weeks ago. And then there's other books that are also on the site, which if you haven't read, Jackie Laura Jones has a great new book called All Peace, No Pieces. And her sister, Cindy Laura Renard, Gary's wife, wrote, of course, in Health and Well-Being. And anyway, I'm actually going to be expanding ACIM blog to include just about any course-related book I can find. So right now there's just a small handful compared to the number of books that will be on the site very soon. So that's my one of my next projects is to make a very complete listing of course-related books on ACI blog. So, but meantime, while you can watch the conversation I have with Bob Rosenthal, also with more recently with Susan Dugan, C.A. Brooks, yourself, and on the homepage, I actually redesigned the layout of the homepage a little bit. So I have, in the first part of the website, I've got recent updates and conversations, just a, you know, a handful of those. And then along kind of the left sidebar now, a left column, I've got talks with Bob Rosenthal, C.A. Brooks, Gary Renard, and Cindy Laura Renard, Jackie Laura Jones, Lynn Johnson, yours truly, and Susan Dugan. Some of the ones that I've had conversations with, of course, authors and prominent folks that I've had conversations with over the years. And I figured, well, why not devote a separate column and a category for each of those? And then I have featured articles, events, items of interest, books, conversations, and video, audio conversations, and others. So anyway, I'm starting to reorganize the site a bit, and the next big update will be an exhaustive, as much as I can find, collection of course-related books. So
wow.
And those purchases are affiliate links, and I always have a little disclaimer there that a disclosure that says we get compensation from those companies in the form of affiliate compensation, but it costs the same, regardless of whether you buy it through Amazon directly or go through our site, exactly the same price to whoever purchases them. What it does is it gives us a little labor of love support, and so I'll be adding that very soon.
Very cool. And that would be a wonderful way to support your work, which is pretty amazing, Bruce, when you really look at it. You know, you just mentioned the whole list of people that you teach with, basically, every day, every week. You are, constantly in communication with people that, Bob Rosenthal and Pam Morgan and Lynn Corona a lot of different people that you are in contact with and working with on a regular basis. And it's so amazing. I don't know how it is that, the two of us ended up together. I think we could have a book. In fact, you could call that whole thing that we did with Gary's book, The Lifetime When Bruce and Lynn Knew Each Other. Because
that's just 1 year's worth of
it. Because, this desire to communicate and to join with others and to help bring this message into the world, it is such a gift. And we're so lucky. I'm so lucky to have everything that I have with A Course in Miracles, with Gather, with just all the work that I do, the DU website and everything. And it's like we're being used.
Absolutely,
it's a joy,
and it's a happy utilization.
It's amazing, and just so makes me so happy. And I'm glad to hear about Dr. Bob's new book, because you're right.
It's wonderful.
I mean, I haven't read it, but I can tell you that the time for raising the message of Jesus' message from A Course in Miracles, from the mundane, which, there's been a lot of really good work done, teaching, whatever, of the lessons of A Course in Miracles. But in a lot of cases, it is really kind of mundane, dumbing down of the message so that it can be palatable to the masses. And that's not what we're here for. We're not here to, try to make it, massage it so that people can accept it. We're here to teach it unequivocally, all or not at all. Basically, that's our job here. So I'm excited to see what he has to say, because bullshit.
I think you will enjoy it, because in very, very easy to read and very enjoyable reading. I actually read the whole book, just about almost 300 pages, very quickly, which is no small feat for me, because I tend to be a slow reader, just because he asked, can I, you know, if I could do a quick review, and so I said, sure, and then, oh, it's 300 pages. So I kind of put my activities in the last day or two on hold, and was reading in the car on the way to Eugene on our monthly errand run, and when Nancy driving, and that half of the trip, and that kind of thing, just sort of so I could, you know, really savor, you know, what's in it quickly, but now I want to go back and reread it again and savor it more slowly because there's so much in it. And, you know, a lot of really great concepts and ideas. One of the ones that we talked about in the conversation that I recorded with Bob a week ago, which is on the website, is a large number of patients that he worked with over the years in a psychotherapy practice had what's, you know, we typically call multiple personality. That sort of alter ego kind of thing, and the word alter is actually the quick shorthand version of one of those multiple personalities is referred to as an alter. So we were joking, you know, because we both like wordplay, and so I said, well, so I have to bring our alters to Holy Spirit's altar for reintegration, huh? And then the acronym for the clinical term is dissociative identity disorder, or DID. So I said, well, that's ego's whole mechanism is it tries to keep us bound to the been there, did that.
Yep, did.
mindset. But anyway, the parallels that he draws between the course's metaphysics and the DID phenomena, you know, and in psychology, so that pathological condition, as it would be referred to, is striking, because I mean, he basically was saying that, you know, we suppress and through dissociation the other parts of ourselves. Well, isn't that what projection is? I mean, I'm a part of the great capital S self that you're a part of and everyone else is a part of. And we could really be thinking in terms of just this planet's human population alone, 7+ billion of us and counting, as, you know, fragments or alters of a giant multiple personality. And he presents his case not only beautifully and elegant, you know, with elegant reasoning, but also in a really accessible way. It's not like one of those scholarly treatises where you say, oh man, I need a break and come back and read another paragraph next week kind of thing. You know, it just flows beautifully, and it's not a lot of, you know, highfalutin jargon that you know you have to, you know, look up every 10th word kind of thing. It's just real obvious, intuitive, easy to understand, but profoundly you know, significant metaphors and analogies and examples that he draws from his practice and just his life experience. And anyway, I just say, you know.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called From Nevermind to Evermind.
From Nevermind to Evermind.
Yeah, and you can pre-order it on Amazon if you follow the link in the sidebar on ACM blog.
Okay, good.
So I encourage people to do that, because I don't think anyone would be disappointed if they're a course student in reading this book. I think it just is a wonderful contribution to course literature. And as I kind of put in this review, I mean, he's really at the heart of the foundation of Course in Miracles, literally and figuratively. So he's in a unique and perfect position to you know, expound on it based on his you know, tremendous history with the Course. I mean, he literally found out about the Course in then Judy Sketch's living room when she first got a hold of it. You know, as a contemporary of Tam and. Based in Tim's brother and Bob were friends, and that's kind of how he ended up learning about the Course from its inception, almost. So anyway.
Yeah, he wasn't even really a seeker or anything. I think he just was a friend, and he went over to visit. And
he was a seeker, but he thought, well, maybe this is, you know, something for someone else, and he read about it and he studied with Bill Pfeffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, he goes way back.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well,
for sure.
I stumbled across it a few years later, but it wasn't until in the late 70s. But it wasn't until the mid 80s that I 84 when I moved to Northern California that I finally cracked open those three volumes and said, oh my gosh, there's some pretty cool stuff in here. So, but yeah, he knew about it early on, and it was, you know, basically being called back to do not only the administrative work that he's doing, and over taking up the mantle of the 27 plus and counting translations that, of course, Miracle's been translated into, that Ken and Whit did so beautifully, and that's certainly a lot of a lot of work there, and obviously with the help of the other colleagues and the foundation, but also to now begin re-emphasizing the discussion part of the distribute, disseminate, and discuss mission that the Foundation for Inner Peace has for the course. So, anyway,
outstanding.
Enough of that. I think it's definitely worth checking out if you're the least bit interested in really good course-related literature, and or if you know someone who might be new to the course but maybe has a scientific bent or a psychological background, or just kind of anybody really who may be kind of curious, like, what's the course about, and wants a really good book to introduce the subject to someone who may not be familiar with it. So, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and I love that. And I was thinking Christmas gifts. That might be a nice thing to get somebody for Christmas. So go to acimblog.com and look for the link and buy the book.
It'll be a pre-order, I think, for a week or two. So it'd be an IOU Christmas gift. If you're okay with that, then
I'm okay with that. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So why don't we get on to our book that we're reading?
Yes.
And I'm just really grateful that you brought this up, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We're reading The Journey Home by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick, and it's about the obstacles to peace. And I guess I'll go ahead and start reading.
Sure.
All right. Chapter 1, The Theory of A Course in Miracles. The sections from Chapter 19 in the text on the four obstacles to peace have always been among my favorite groups of sections. These sections together comprise an excellent in-depth summary of the entire thought system of A Course in Miracles, tying together all of the major themes of the course. These range from the metaphysical theme of how God did not create the world and the body, and indeed knows absolutely nothing about them, to the specific teachings of guilt and projection and their undoing through the practice of forgiveness in our special relationships. There are also some beautiful and incisive passages where Jesus speaks of himself and the projections that have been put upon him, emphasizing the important role the ego has given him in its thought system. This distortion is corrected by his making clear the nature of the role he has in his thought system, undoing the ego through helping us to change our minds about what we think and perceive. And this is really an interesting distinction he's making here. Is that getting into where we projected on Jesus, a person, a personality, and a role. And, I think what I've seen a lot recently, well, I've always kind of seen this since I've been studying the course, that there are people who would rather concentrate on Jesus's relationship with Helen and Bill and the discussions that Jesus and Helen had about the mundane things of their life and what it was that Jesus helping Helen buy a coat or helping Helen all of the mundane things of life that that Jesus and Helen shared. And so they're looking for their own personal Jesus who's going to do that same thing with them. And that is a misnomer. I mean, I don't know misnomer, that's a misnaming. But it's a misconception that...
it's sort of a misapplication of the ideas of the course. There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
It's just that it's not the intent of the course at all. I think another great book and reference that I'm due to reread is Absence from Felicity, which is Ken's wonderful biography about Helen Schuckman.
Yes, I love that book.
He clarifies a whole lot of stuff about Helen's personal life and the schism between the tremendously, profoundly lucid aligned state that she got into when she was the scribe, of course, and then how, a split second later, she could be off, doing something that related to her personal life and her investment in that, in her mind, and how she could then be completely disconnected from that voice. But isn't that what we all do? I mean, we have those moments where we're lucid, and then we have, typically, if we're honest with ourselves, huge portions of the day when we go about doing the what's in it for Bruce, what's in it for Lynn, thinking that's the important part of life. And not that we shouldn't do those things, but if we can do them with a mindful awareness and just kind of like a little inner smile, that, oh yeah, this is what these little characters that we call humans do in a dream, and to gently laugh at, and not in a derisive way, but in a very gentle way. It's like, okay, this too shall pass. And then, with enough practice of remembering to be mindful and being consistent with that, I will gradually transform my identity using the decision-making faculty in the mind from body to spirit. And Ken is also going through that in a book I just started or picked up again. I'm still in the early pages with some of the Greek philosophers, the Neoplatonists, and all that kind of stuff. Is Love Does Not Condemn, which is his more scholarly treatment of Gnosticism, Platonism, Christianity, and the Course, and probably a few other isms and things along the way historically. But it's a fascinating read too. It's much more scholarly, but he certainly, points out all the different ways that we get distracted by the form and it's purposive. And in fact, Bob Rosenthal, one of the first things in his new second book points out I've got it in front of me here. Let me just grab it real quick. Let's read that paragraph. Did I close the? I'll open it up again. But he talks about the enormous resistance we have to practicing the ideas in the Course, because it is a very challenging curriculum, it's because we have this enormous resistance. But right at the introduction, he says, there it is. Okay, says writing about A Course in Miracles is not an easy or straightforward task. It may well be the most challenging spiritual system of all to unpack and explain. The reason for this is that the Course in its essence is simple, but our resistance to hearing its message is intense. Well, there again, there's Helen's famous quote, I know it's true, I just don't believe it, and that's our ambivalence that we all have. That we're all, basically working through that, and that's what A Course in Miracles is here to do. For all of us remedial students the blocks of the awareness of what's present. Right? So, and that's what this book we're reading is all about, undoing the obstacles to peace. So.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about this whole thing of his relationship with Helen. And, of course, we are, I think, for the most part, pretty well aware that there really is no voice of another person talking to Helen, as there is no voice of another person talking to us. The ego and the bicameral mind theory there, that before we the two sections of the brain were connected, the voice that we heard from whatever seemed like it was coming from God to us. This voice that comes from these things that come to us that are not our own thoughts, but of course none of them are our own thoughts. None of the thoughts that we think with the ego are our thoughts, and we don't even really hear the thoughts of God. We're only hearing variations of ego thought that are either more or less aligned with the truth. And so, more or less aligned with love, let me just say that, rather than the truth. It's either love or something else. And so, Helen was hearing this voice and not even recognizing that it was her own higher self that was talking to her, just as it is the same own higher self that we all possess, or that is what we are. And so, you know, she had her own relationship with that because it was her. And just like I have my own relationship with Jesus, who I, you know, call something else, you know, my own, you know, inner guide, or my higher self is basically what I usually call it. But we're all hearing it. And mm-hmm. and it's not, you know, Jesus didn't tell her go buy a coat at this place, because it was in the script she was going to buy a coat at that place. That was already written long ago. It wasn't like some new novel idea that came out of nowhere. No, that was already in the script. So even to imagine that Jesus was the one that told her to go there is to misconstrue who Jesus is. And
well, the Course itself, you know, uses the phrase, I'm going to paraphrase slightly, I think, but, you know, the things in the world that, you know, appear to be the, you know, the agents of healing merely give form to our desire, and that's, and that, which is our choice in the mind for one of two thought systems. And so, you know, in this, the case of Helen's, you know, shopping guide, that which she ascribed to Jesus helping her buy pantyhose or find a parking place or whatever it was, you know, those are just projections within, you know, that particular seemingly separate self, that, you know, that fragmented, that altar, if you will, mind that we call Helen, that's no different than the altar or fragment or split off schizophrenic personality aspect of the one being that we call Lynn or Bruce or whoever else is listening right now. So but the whole point of it is to undo gradually, gracefully, and but, you know, we can take a, you know, basically a, you know, a supersonic transport trip, or we can, you know, take an ox cart, you know, depending on our, how much resistance we put up. And as you point out, you know, it's all kind of written in the sense that, you know, we may be able to make quantum jumps, but within each script in all the parallel universes, the script is written. So, but why not take the quantum circuit and, you know, guide and route home if we have that available, if we're ready for it? And I think if you're listening to this, and I count Lynn and myself as two participants listening to this, because we're hopefully sharing something that's coming through us and not from us, if we're doing our job right, you know, we're ready for that information, right? And we're ready for that understanding, and that's why we were drawn to A Course in Miracles and drawn to that, the mellows between the lines of its brilliant, poetic verse, right?
So, exactly. And you know, Helen did believe it. She said she didn't believe, but she actually did believe it. But Jesus tells us that there's a, that's part of the ladder there. You have to have a belief to be open to the knowledge. And
yeah, it was just a whimsical way of saying, you know, that she had enormous resistance like everyone else, because she was still doing the equivocation, you know, dance that we all do in this world, and was acknowledging the fact that you know, the entrenchment of the ego, you know, is the challenge. I mean, it's really the only challenge that we have. It's the only one remaining obstacle in our lives to peace, and the only remaining choice that we have is really to choose the other teacher that doesn't you know, buy into the resistance, and that gives us the laser vision to blast through ego's resistance. And but we have to do that on our own pace. We can't force that either, you know. And you know, the Course says, "Do not fight yourself." And so, if we find ourselves resisting, the thing to do is, you know, back off and know that sooner or later we'll be ready to let go of that resistance and go further. So hopefully, our conversations are an example of the willingness to go further, and and for those who want to join in the mind that we all are already joined in, hopefully this can be truly helpful.
Well, it is for me, so that's all that matters.
Sure, it's for me too. So this seemingly separate self is benefiting from it. So
I'll just finish this little section and then you can read heaven. Okay. I should like, in this introductory chapter, to summarize briefly the course's theoretical teachings as a framework for the entire book. Fuller treatment of the complete theory of A Course in Miracles can be found in numerous books and tape sets, such as a talk given on A Course in Miracles, Forgiveness and Jesus, The Meeting Place of A Course in Miracles in Christianity. Wow, these are long titles. Awaken from the Dream and The Message of A Course in Miracles, Volumes 1 and 2, and The Simplicity of Salvation and The Metaphysics of Separation and Forgiveness. So these are all books or recordings. And like I said, I have a bunch of these because Aussie gave me like all her VHS tapes and cassette tapes, and then her friend Billy Diggs sent me a whole box full of cassette tapes, and so I have all these Ken Wapnick recordings in all different forms and formats. But if you don't have a cassette player or a VHS player, kind of does you no good. But anyway, go on. I'm rambling.
Yeah. Well, just you mentioned one of the ideas in that first paragraph that I think was important too is that, you know, we need to forgive our projected versions of certainly Jesus in the traditional formal religious sense. And you know, and in the Course's version too, because we project all of our resistance and all of our unforgiveness onto the teacher of forgiveness, and so it seems kind of crazy. Well, why would we need to forgive? Well, it's because we project all our unconscious guilt onto, you know, any convenient target, and if we start studying the Course, there's a convenient target, you know, to use our blame thrower on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly God. And I was when you first made that comment a few moments ago, Lynn, about that whole principle of projection and some obviously level of confusion, I was thinking, how many times in a week do I hear some kind of phrase or another, usually on the news, where, you know, it was God's will that this happened, you know, whether it's a natural disaster or some kind of a catastrophe of some sort, or disease, or, you know, it's like God gets blamed for a whole bunch of stuff, you know, and that's the nature of projection, is we want to take the unpleasantness of the thoughts that the ego is really founded on and get it out of here, you know, get it away from me, kind of thing. And that's the whole purpose of projection, and that's why we made up an entire world to try to escape from, albeit unsuccessfully, the unconscious guilt, sin, and fear, and ultimately death that the ego's whole thought system revolves around. So, in contrast to that, we have heaven. The starting point in any discussion of the Course's theory must be God, since He and He alone is reality and truth, beside whom nothing exists. Since reality in A Course in Miracles is non-dualistic, abstract, and non-specific, it is impossible for the brain, conditioned by the dualistic thought system of the ego, to comprehend a dimension that transcends this duality entirely. Therefore, we shall simply state that the principal characteristic of heaven is its perfect unity or wholeness, outside of which is nothing. For how can nothing exist outside perfect oneness, let alone exist at all? Though again not comprehensible to our limited human understanding, the concept of oneness nevertheless remains absolutely central to Jesus' teachings in A Course in Miracles on the dynamic strategy of the ego and the ego's reversal, correction, and ultimate undoing by the Holy Spirit. There's a whole lot in that paragraph, huh?
Excuse me, yes, and I've been trying not to cough while you were reading. Absolutely. And I guess that's the starting point of everything is, you know, what do we think or what we believe that God is, and what we believe in, you know, do you have a thought about what unity or wholeness is? Can we even fathom what that is? I think, you know, we all have our own ideas, but my God is not the same as your God. I can almost guarantee it.
from the ego's perspective, certainly, that's the whole point of Ken basically starting out with these profoundly radical, in the best sense of that word, definitive statements of pure non-duality. And that's, again, another thing that I really admire in obviously both Ken's work and Gary Renard's work, is the Martin and Peirce's gentle, patient, return, as we were talking about earlier this morning, how the teachings of that caliber that bring us back to inexorably to the pure non-dual awareness and our longing for it are really the only thing that's going to satisfy us. Because if we just go part way toward a goal, it's like, well, I almost got to whatever it is I was trying to do. Well, you'll close the little counts and horseshoes kind of thing. I think this is certainly true in non-duality, is that, as long as there's one little speck of duality, it's still duality,
Exactly.
And the beauty of it is we don't have to do anything. We just have to undo. And the only place we have to undo is in our mind. And the only thing in our mind that we have to undo is a belief that can be undone by allowing ourselves and basically enlisting the help on a more and more consistent basis of our inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, to get that reversal, correction, and ultimate undoing going. And we're already well underway. We wouldn't be having this conversation, and whoever's listening wouldn't be listening, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And the whole idea of oneness, the whole idea of wholeness, is so impossible for the ego to fathom. And this is the major obstacle, really. I mean, if there's any differences in obstacles, the major obstacle here is saying that you and I are the same. You and I deserve the same thing. You and I have the same everything. So, which basically says that I can't be unhappy about anything about you. I can't judge you and be unhappy about it. I can't look at you and wish that you were different. I can't want some other outcome for you than I want for me. I want the same thing for the both of us. That's the biggest thing we have to overcome here, is this idea that there are differences, and that those differences have a meaning. And I didn't really, I could say, yes, we are one, we are whole, we are blah, blah, blah. But until I started actually experiencing the connection of oneness, it was just a theory to me. It was a good idea. It was something nice that I liked to say and hear. But when I started realizing the wholeness and the connection of us in oneness, and understanding on a very deep level that no part of us can be left out, is what you were saying. It's either all or nothing. No, you can't leave it one outside. You can't say this one is so bad that he can't come in. You can't say, I would rather he didn't come in here because I don't like him. You have to accept that every single one of us is one of us. And I can't be without that. I can't be without him no matter what I think about him. I can't exist in the universe without, universe, one song. I can't exist in the universe with when I have something separate and outside.
Yeah. And I was just thinking how, just an everyday example where we can kind of clarify the level of confusion that easily can arise is we're always and only talking about the mind here. And if I were to try to apply that on a level of form, to say, well, if I have a potluck, I need to invite everybody on the planet. There goes the rest of my life, mailing out those 7+ billion invitations to the potluck, because there's no way I can keep up with, you know, getting everybody invited, let alone finding a venue to house the potluck. but you know, just on an everyday level, you know, it's like I can have an appreciation and a respect for the idea that there may be a flea on a squirrel or a chipmunk out in the yard that prances around our deck eating the birdseed that my wife puts out to entertain our cats when the squirrels come to eat it, or the badgers, not badgers, the other critters,
squirrels, gophers.
the raccoons that sometimes we see out there eating the birdseed. We know that there's bears too, and it doesn't mean, you know, you have to invite all those animals into your house. You can still appreciate that they're part of the sonship, they're part of that perfect oneness, but you don't have to invite them in on a level of form to your living area, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm not responsible for that part of their. I mean, everybody's responsible for their own part in the play, and that's, you know, you got to expect them all to do it. But you got to include them all, or else you can't say I wish that there weren't badgers or raccoons coming in my yard. But that's, again, you know, why go against what is? You know, Byron Katie, you know, when you argue with what is, you just make yourself unhappy. You know,
maybe I said, instead of raccoons, mentioned badgers because of UHF. In the Weird Al Yankovic movie, where the guy who has the pet show on the little TV station, and there's somebody unloading all these animals that he's going to use on his show, and the guy hands him a cage, and he says, "What's in that?" And badgers, and he says, "Badgers? We don't need no stinking badgers."
Yes.
Which, if you don't remember an earlier TV show, that will be totally lost. But anyway,
I love it.
Yeah. So, but and that's again another reminder to, you know, to not take this too seriously, because the world that is dualistic is a joke. I mean, and you know, one of the most, I think, important lines in A Course in Miracles is that, you know, to paraphrase, that this apparent dream is something that we forgot to laugh about. You know, we remembered not to laugh at the silly, tiny, mad idea. And if we can remember that and just, again, have a little gentle smile, you know, whether it crosses our face or just our mind, you know, depending on the circumstance, if, you know, throughout the day, sometimes I'll do that when I'm exercising, you know, I'll see myself flailing my body around, doing all these things in a local exercise class that is held three times a week down to the local community center, and I'll just look around the room and I'll see people doing, you know, pretty, you know, great focus and sincerity and a certain amount of seriousness, and I'll think to myself, yeah, I'm taking good care of my body, and that's all well and good, but then I just kind of, it's all pretty silly, the things that we do, you know, in order to maintain these vehicles. It's kind of outrageously hilarious at times, you know. But anyway, maybe we should go on.
Okay, yeah. I just had a vision in my mind of you flailing around at the exercise class.
It's not quite that bad. All these things where you move your hands and legs and all these different things. Yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's sort of like going to a dance class and occasionally they even play some pretty good music. But you know, just to remember to not take it so seriously. Whatever.
Exactly. Well, you know, and this is something that I think is an interesting. It has to do with perspective and time. My daughter is she's a historian, and she loves American history. And so, you know, we're talking about the current situation in the country. And, you know, how insane is this? And then she starts telling me stories about our founding fathers, some of the crazy, insane things that they did. You know, one of the vice presidents went off and tried to start his own country. They shot each other. They had duels. You think this is bad? You know, I mean, this is the same thing, only different, right? The same insanity. And she's telling me these stories, and we're in the kitchen just laughing our butts off at all the craziness that was going on, and, you know, still looking at the TV going, oh my God, this is the worst thing that ever happened, you know, and it's like, no, it's not. This is all in 100 years, people are going to be looking at this, sitting in their kitchens laughing their asses off at how ridiculous the world is. So why not laugh now? You know, I mean, does it seem unseemly to look at this stuff and laugh at it and say, how ridiculous can this be? Is it because we think we have a moral duty to be angry or upset? Or is it just because we are taking it so seriously and thinking something really bad is happening that in 100 years we'll look back at and say, you know, how silly. Why not say that now? Why not do that now? So, okay, so I'm going to...
And if a seam is something that is, you know, a split or a place where something's divided, then unseemly could be a good thing.
Maybe it could be a good thing to be unseemly. And yeah, Carrie says we used to fight in Congress, literally. Yeah, they would have fist fights. And they do it in other countries. You see it all the time. They'll show on, you know, the Japanese diet this week went on a, you know, rampage, and they were duking it out. You know, it's like, what's happening?
The diet didn't go on a diet. Of course, our Congress sometimes seems incongruous to me.
Yes, exactly.
And that's just a projection of my own split mind.
Exactly. And we always go on.
Anyway. Not that doesn't mean that, you know, we can exercise our imaginary freedom of choice, and perhaps should, and I do routinely, is you know, to the ballot box. But I figure if I can remember to keep it in perspective, I'm voting for one of two thought systems, 24/7, 365. In fact, if I'm going to get really granular and nerdy about it, about 10 to the 44th times per second, as quantum physics might suggest, that with the Planck time constant, where the universe literally strobes in and out of existence, you know, one with 44 zeros after it, times per second, give or take, that's a lot of stroboscopic decision points where I could choose peace or not at any given moment. So there's a whole lot of opportunities to change your mind. So not that we're consciously aware of that granularity, but it's just kind of a reminder of the power of our minds to make a system that we've gone so far down the rabbit hole that, you know, who knows, maybe theoretically at any one of those choice points we could get back on the Holy Spirit's track and off the ego's track. And that's why I think, you know, that the power of decision is our own, as Cliff points out, and we can choose once again at any moment to see peace instead of the ego's interpretation of things.
Absolutely. And I was going to just put a little aside. Take enough acid, and you will see that stroboscoping going on. You see the universe going a completely different direction. Anyway, not suggesting to do that. We're all too old for that.
You should mention that, because Bob Rosenthal briefly touches on, you know, some of the psychedelics and ayahuasca and mescaline and different things, and some of the, you know, people historically that have gone that route and then realized that, well, that wasn't the answer either. I mean, yeah, it may provide an opening kind of thing, but you know, to have a sustainable experience of pure non-duality, you have to go to the mind, and using an external means may or may not be helpful for you, but it's certainly not a permanent solution.
Right.
And he also discusses in a very lucid way how science, religion, and philosophy all in isolation fall short of the mark, because they're all based on taking the world at face value rather than incorporating the metaphor of the dream and realizing that each one of those approaches, while, you know, valid in the intent, A Course in Miracles says, trust not your good intentions.
Yeah.
Not enough.
That's
because
true.
We need the vision that transcends the world as we made it up in order to go beyond it. In the same way that Einstein said, you know, you can't solve a problem from the system that made it up within the system.
Exactly. And also to just remind folks that even if you do like have some kind of a experience with a drug like ayahuasca or LSD or or mushrooms or marijuana or alcohol or anything.
Coffee.
It's all from inside of you. It's not coming from anywhere else. It's not like, you know, you take this and all of a sudden some external influence comes into you. It's your own mind. So it's, you know, whatever you do, it's your own mind. So it's not like, you know, people, you know, I don't see anything wrong with it if you want to do it. It's nothing, you know, I've found it very helpful in the past. And I have not done ayahuasca. I was invited to, in January, go to someplace here in Colorado and do that. But, you know, I just don't really see a point to it. You know, at this point in my life, I might later on, who knows. But John Mundy did a lot of this kind of stuff as well. And you read about it in his books. He's very very open about, you know, his internal exploration through drugs. And not that he was doing a lot of drugs, but for that purpose. You know, he went to, you know, South America and, you know, went through this. It wasn't ayahuasca. It was something else, some combination of things. But you can see, you know, that, you know, he was able to, you know, find a purpose in it, and it was part of his internal exploration, not just doing it for kicks, but which is okay too if you want to do it for kicks.
Is everything, yeah, right? It's
yeah.
The why, it makes all the difference.
Yeah, it makes all the difference. So, okay, well, I'm going to read. The Tiny Mad Idea and the Split Mind. Again, we're reading The Journey Home, Dr. Kenneth Wapnick, about the obstacles to peace. Okay. It is because of this perfect oneness of heaven that when the tiny mad idea of being separate from God seemed to arise within the sonship, the Holy Spirit's atonement principle, the answer to the thought of separation, must only be that this thought could never be, and so it never happened. Yet there was certainly the belief that it could, and this resulted on what we can think of as a tripartite split mind. And I'm not sure I know what tripartite...
Three parts.
So it's a three-part split mind?
He goes into that, as you probably...
Okay, I'm going to read it now and figure it out.
With the decision maker... And the you know, the thought system, the ego and thought system of the Holy Spirit. I think that's what he's referring to, but let's find out.
Okay. So it should be mentioned before we proceed any further that all that follows in our discussion is basically a Course in Miracles myth. It begins with the separation from God and the origin of the world and concludes with salvation through forgiveness, culminating in the return to heaven. Moreover, since the separation never happened to begin with, we are merely speaking about symbols for what seemed to happen, and therefore does not truly exist. The reader should keep this in mind as we continue the development of the sun's journey through the ego thought system, and then its ultimate undoing. In addition, the ego and the Holy Spirit are spoken of in anthropomorphic terms, as if they were human beings, and as if they were real people. Again, in truth, everything in our story from the tiny mad idea on is illusory. Both the problem of guilt and its correction of forgiveness. Therefore, at some point, the mythological model we are adopting will break down under the probing logic of an intellectually sophisticated brain. Readers, therefore, are urged to let the images of this myth play in their minds, as they would with the symbols of a great poet or the musical images of a consummate composer.
Yeah. And that right there is a wonderful statement of, you know, definitive statement of the pure non-duality of the Course and how, you know, the whole curriculum of forgiveness is also part of the myth. And he points that out so very nicely. Because... you know, anything that is apart from perfect oneness, including the return to it, that implies that it happened in the first place, has to be part of the mythology. But the beauty of Course in Miracles myth is that the atonement principle, including forgiveness, you know, salvation, all the different words that you used to describe that process, and the ultimate resolution, reconciliation and integration are just part of the mythology. But the important but here is, because that's where we think we are, the Course is written from the perspective of an ego mind, because that's how we can relate to it, and we can see the contrast, and we can experience the peace that results, even if it's just a few moments at a time, a few holy instants at a time, when we look at our relationships and undo those projections and bring it back in and forgive. Because the forgiveness really is the one myth, so to speak, that leads to the undoing. And for that reason, that's why there's so much emphasis on it, because it leads, it's the one, you know, general practice that leads out of the insanity of a really whacked out dream. So, anyway, on that note, it looks like we've run out of time, so we're conveniently at the bottom of page 8. We can start at the top of page 9 next week. How's that sound?
That sounds great, and that'll be a really good time to talk about this whole idea of separation, because that's exactly, you know, what this chapter is about, and if really truly understanding, you know, what happened or what we think happened, and how it couldn't possibly be, is really the key to salvation. So and of course forgiveness. So anyway, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and I do appreciate it. And I'll see you next week. Thank you everyone for joining us on the journey home, and I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to Iris and Carrie.
Have a great week, all.
Bye-bye.